You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John C. Gordon, the former dean of the Yale School of Forestry, has said that if you were to look at Connecticut from above in the summer, you'd see mostly unbroken forest. If you did it after the leaves had fallen for most of the trees, you'd see mostly stockbrokers. The idea that some of the country's most densely populated areas are also the most heavily forested is at the heart of my guest's latest book. It's called Nature Wars, and in it, Jim Sterber examines the confrontation that occurs between the humans who have moved into lands that were once considered wild and the wild animals that have adapted to these newly settled suburban surroundings. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased that it brings Jim Sterber to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Haven't you spent most of your career as a foreign correspondent and national reporter for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times? That's a far cry from the concerns of this book, isn't it?
It is. But when I went to work for the Wall Street Journal, they said I could live wherever I wanted to and commute to Asia. But when I was here, they said you have to find something to write about. And I'm a Michigan farm kid, and so I began to see changes in the land, which interested me, and I started writing about deer hunting and so on.
I remember going through Michigan some years back and noticing that a lot of former farmland had been returned to forests.
Same
people
in New York.
Abandoned the farms.
Yeah, same in New York State. I think it's still happening in New York State.
You say that it's very likely that more people live in closer proximity to more wild animals in the eastern United States today than anywhere on the planet at any time in history. More people than in the Amazon or in the African bush?
There aren't very many people in the Amazon, actually, compared to the people who live in the eastern United States. I did a survey, and it's about 210 million people now. And we closer proximity, okay, it's weasel-worded, as we say in journalism. But we're all out there next to these creatures because we live in the sprawl. A majority of us now live... Absolute majority live not in cities, not on farms, but in this vast in-between donut.
Well, suburbia to some degree has become as dense as the cities, and now it's exurbia that functions in the way that suburbia used to.
That's right. And when you consider that the habitat is back and there are all these corridors for wild creatures to move around in, and there's no family farms to control these creatures as there used to be, you have a mess of riches, essentially.
And you say that wildlife populations have swelled because forests on the East Coast have been regenerating since the 19th century?
Farms began to be abandoned in New England in the early to mid part of the 19th century when the Erie Canal opened and people spilled out into the Midwest and found this incredibly rich, flat, relatively fertile land. Farmers began to abandon their marginal land in New England, the stony hillsides, the pastures and so on.
But that goes against the prevailing narrative, doesn't it? All we've been hearing for quite a while is we're getting rid of farmland and natural habitats to build housing developments.
Well, we're doing a lot of that, but the forests took over this landscape before the developers did. And David Foster, the head of the Harvard Research Forest, says that we have a rare second chance because of this forest regrowth to do it right this time. Otherwise, hard deforestation, as he calls development, will pave it over.
But you say that at the very beginning there was also deforestation. Did that have a negative effect on the situation in the area we're discussing, our area here?
Sure. It certainly took away the habitat for all sorts of creatures, and then remember, commercial hunters were at work for hundreds of years before the end of the 19th century, and they decimated wild populations of almost anything that had a commercial value for meat, feathers, fur, whatever.
So are the animals that we're seeing now returning, or have we brought them back?
A combination of both. The conservation movement at the end of the 19th century took remnant populations. I mean, for example, people think the deer population was about 30 million in the year 1600. By 1900, it was down to, by a couple of estimates, less than 500,000. Now it's back up to anywhere from 30 to 50 million, and we are living in the heart of the white-tailed deer's historic range.
So we have perhaps more deer now than we had when the settlers arrived in the first place?
Yes.
The New York Times published an article in 2010 that found trees in the Chesapeake Bay area were growing 2 to 4 times faster than normal because of rising levels of CO2 in the air. What sort of effect does the speed of regrowth have on wildlife populations?
I don't know that. I think that far more important is that people are not managing these wild populations like they used to, and or especially in areas where they are growing the fastest, like sprawl. There are very few predators. I mean, and the biggest predator, for example, of deer is, since the last ice age, we think, has been people.
Not mountain lions.
Well, mountain lions and wolves are the two species that count on killing deer to eat. But there's some research that suggests that we have been the top predator, and in fact that we Native Americans, Paleo-Americans, killed more deer than all the other predators of deer combined. So, and now we've taken ourselves largely off of the predator roles.
Well, there is all that debate over when hunting season should occur and whether we should have them at all. You're saying that hunting seasons are good in some cases because they keep the deer population under control?
I think that's true in many areas, but I think that without hunting and predation in sprawl areas, that these deer populations are spiraling. For example, in Princeton, when Princeton in 2000, after arguing for years over what to do with the growing deer population, estimated that they had 94 deer per square mile in the township. In the normal countryside, they are not normal, but in an unpeopled area, you might have 10 to 15 deer per square mile. More than that, and they begin to manage your forest for you.
So there's a lot of deer in Princeton itself, in the town.
Oh, in the township, yes.
Wow. What
they,
about?
Well, they decided eventually, after fighting with each other, they broke up into factions, and I call them species partisans, save the deer, kill the deer, blah, blah. And this went on for years. And finally, the mayor, Phyllis Marchand, decided to hire a sharpshooting company. And there was a big kerfuffle over that. But eventually, they got the deer population down from 2,000 to what it is now. I think it's 500, and they're going to cull the herd down to 300 again this winter.
Do they have to kill them? Can't they just capture them and take them to some place where there are fewer deer?
Nobody wants them.
What about some of the other animals that are natural to the area, like wolves and like mountain lions?
Well, there are about 100,000 mountain lions or cougars in the country, and most of them are in the west, but they're gradually coming east. Remember the one that was killed in Connecticut a while ago, that had come all the way from the Black Hills. Wolves the same way. They're turning up slowly but surely, but they were taken off the landscape as destructive vermin hundreds of years ago in this area.
Are they showing up in Princeton as well?
I haven't seen any in Princeton.
You use an island off the coast of Maine to illustrate forest regeneration. Can you tell us about the changes that occurred on Mount Desert Island after European settlers arrived there in 1613? What did it look like?
Well, what happened was that they began to clear the landscape to grow, to farm. They wanted to, like all settlers from Europe, they wanted to recreate the pastoral landscape that they left behind. And they cleared trees, and they used the wood for all sorts of purposes, but in a lot of cases just to get rid of it so that they could farm. And by 1880, Mount Desert was about 50% deforested. It's got a lot of mountains, so the trees hug the hillsides. But since then, those forests have grown back, partly because they were protected and became part of Acadia National Park. But people who go up there, the point of that story is that when people go to Mount Desert, they see what looks like this huge old spruce forest, and they think it's always been that way.
But you say that it's, you say desert?
Mount Desert, yeah.
Even though it's spelled like desert?
That's right.
Mount Desert Island is in many ways a microcosm of what happened to the rest of much of America's forested land.
That's right. Remember, three-quarters of our forests, three-quarters of the forests of the contiguous U.S. are in the eastern third of the country, from the Atlantic coast to where the trees run out in the high plains.
That would also surprise a lot of people.
It would, because we think of the forest as being in the northwest, the spotted owl and so on. But those are relatively recent fights that people have had over forests on federal lands. But essentially, the forests were all in the east, three-quarters of them.
My guest is Jim Sterba, S-T-E-R-B-A. His book, Nature Wars, The Incredible Story of How Wildlife Comebacks Turned Backyards into Battlegrounds. It is published by Crown. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jim Sterba. His book, Nature Wars, The Incredible Story of How Wildlife Comebacks Turned Backyards into Battlegrounds, published by Crown. While many might suggest that humans encroached on the natural habitats of local animals with this, with our expansion into the suburbs and exurbia, you said that's only half the story. So what's the other half?
The other half is that they've encroached right back. We found that even really what we thought to be people-shy species like wild turkeys and coyotes have adapted really well to our space, the sprawl, and there are several reasons for that. I mean, we provide them with lots of food. We provide them with shelter and edges and water, hiding spaces. I mean, the coyote can have some pups in the brush in back of your garage. I have a friend who studies them in Chicago, and he estimates that there are 2,000 coyotes in downtown Chicago. There are no predators because we've taken ourselves out. The coyotes kill things. They kill fawns mostly in terms of deer, and they may catch a few other things, but they're not serious predators of anything but mice and rabbits and so on.
And that has led many people to be concerned. In the past, it was nice seeing a deer on your lawn. Now you start freaking out about the possibility of Lyme disease.
Well, that's true. I've just read a wonderful book by a researcher in Millbrook who suggests that deer may be the carriers of ticks into a new region, but once they're there, they stay there because of things like mice, chipmunks, even robins, and those animals carry the virus and infect the ticks.
Now, you talked about all the deer in Princeton. Aren't there 2,000 coyotes in the Chicago area?
Right.
Coyotes?
Yes, that's right. And in Los Angeles, and, you know, a couple turned up in Manhattan a while back, if you'll recall. They really get around, and they've spread from their native range, which is the high plains, the dry high plains, over the years, and there's plenty for them to eat.
Well, so do they function like feral dogs? I mean, do they roam around in packs and then go into garbage cans?
No. The ones I know about are sort of singles or families and so on, and they'll prey on your house cat or small dogs and so on. But they're really not threatening. I mean, if you throw a rock at them, they'll run away. But the problem is that people feed these creatures, and once you feed coyotes, bears, squirrels, and so on, they're going to stay around.
They leave food out for bears?
Yeah. Well, bears will – they put their garbage cans out. Bears get into the garbage cans. And then I've heard these stories so often. I was with a Florida wildlife guy who's on the bear patrol in Orlando. And he said the problem is that people see a bear out back looting their garbage cans, and they say, oh, my goodness, get a donut, throw it to him, get the camera, let's take its picture. And that's the worst thing you can do because the bear begins to associate food with humans, and the scent of humans doesn't scare him away anymore. Pretty soon he's trying to get in your backyard or back porch.
And we're seeing them more often because there are fewer places for them to hide?
There are more of the animals. As their populations grow, they spread. They need territory, and they go to wherever they can find space where there are no other competing bears.
You're right that there are 3,000 to 4,000 deer-to-automobile collisions every day. Is that the most significant danger that deer represent to humans?
Yes. Deer car crashes kill about 200 to 250 people a year. They put 30,000 in the hospital.
And they kill a lot of deer.
And they kill all of those deer, which is a tremendous waste of deer.
You'd figure, I know I almost hit a deer driving on the road. It just jumped out right in front of the car. Luckily, my foot was close to the brake. But I wondered about it. The deer don't look both ways when they cross the road.
That's right.
You would think by now they would have figured it out.
Well, the problem is that, I mean, the reason people get injured a lot is that they swerve. They go into the ditch and hurt themselves. They swerve the other way, hit an oncoming car. The advice is to just drive right straight through the deer and brake and slow down and stop. And, of course, be careful when you're driving at dusk and dawn and at night.
You note that white-tailed deer populations have risen and fallen in three waves over the last 400 years. Are those changes all the result of human sprawl?
I would say no. Deer populations have grown in their range because there are fewer and fewer hunters to keep them in check. Hunters are aging. Actually, there's been an uptick in hunting in the last 5 years. But hunters kill about 6 million deer a year. Cars kill another, say, 2 million. Let's say all other forms of predation, 6 million. So there's 14. But that doesn't begin to stabilize the population of the deer. More intensely manage them to just keep the population stable.
Another animal that seems problematic for suburban residents is the beaver. I never realized how big the typical beaver is. Can you talk about their physical traits?
The chapter is called the 50-pound rodent, and these they're about the size of a Labrador Retriever without the long legs. They have short legs and this tail, and they look sort of lumbering on land, but once you get them in the water, they're torpedoes. They can really move around, and they are like us, land managers. They can engineer their landscape for their own purposes, which is to build lodges and dams and for protection.
And are those dams harmful to humans?
When they flood your backyard or your well or your sewer system, or they chew down your prized tree in the front yard, they become very damaging.
And biologists refer to them as a keystone species?
Right. They manage the landscape, and they create wetlands, which is very valuable. And one of the reasons why conservationists wanted to bring them back. The trouble is that they were all gone from the landscape before any settlers got here. So there were beaver meadows in Concord, Mass., for example, but no beavers. They'd all been trapped out and sold to Europe to pay for the trips for the settlers to get here. And they were all trapped out way ahead of settlement. So we had no experience living with beavers until recently.
Well, the beavers are a part of the New York iconography, but do we see many beavers in New York State?
Oh, there are lots of beavers in New York State. In New York City, they're mostly on fur pieces, but and also on the insignia of the city. There are five creatures. One is a Native American, one's a Dutchman, one's an eagle, and two of them are beavers, which shows you how important the beaver trade was to this city.
In 2001, beavers were at the center of a public debate in Massachusetts. Can you tell us about the controversy caused by that state's Wildlife Protection Act? It became a ballot issue, didn't it?
It became a ballot initiative in 1996, and the issue was, should we ban what were called cruel traps, the foothold trap and something called a conibear, a snapping egg beater kind of trap. And Massachusetts voters by a margin of 2-1, voted to ban these traps, which were, of course, the primary means by which you control the beaver population.
So what has been the result?
Well, the
explosion of beavers?
The beaver population has shot up like crazy. People were complaining about beavers. The Massachusetts wildlife people said if we did nothing else, we'd be answering beaver complaints all the time. So they delegated responsibility for controlling them to the municipal health boards, and it just became this. Beavers continued to be killed, but it just out of sight in people's minds.
Well, part of the problem for some people also is if you catch a beaver on your property, trap it, and then take it out to the woods and cross a county line, you're committing a crime.
It's illegal in many, if not most, states to relocate wildlife because you're relocating them to where there's competition. They may be spreading disease. The animals are put under a lot of stress, and the mortality for them is high. So that's why they think it's a bad idea.
A listener, Dom from New Jersey, commented on a show page that deer are often in his driveway noshing, and bears have chewed holes in his bear-proof $100 trash can. He wonders if you have any suggestions of effective measures that homeowners can take to keep the animals at bay. You point out in your book that the bear population in New Jersey nearly doubled between the years 1995 and 2000.
Bears adapted to suburbs and sprawl just as easily as a lot of other creatures. And as I said, as their populations grow, they spread. And the advice is don't feed them, that's for sure. And the second advice is, I suppose, get a stronger garbage can.
Well, a $100 trash can sounds pretty strong.
Maybe there's a $500 bear-proof trash can. I know the national parks have them.
Well, even though more Americans now live among more animals, as you suggest here, you also say that we've never been farther away from understanding them.
We've become, I say, denatured over the last century, mainly because we moved off of the land. We moved off of farms. My parents and grandparents were farmers. I grew up on a farm in the 50s in Michigan, but most people have become suburbanites or urbanites. They don't get their hands dirty out there farming, and so they've lost touch with, and they get their nature on film, TV, and essentially digitally piped in, and where it can be edited to create bears, for example, that behave just like little people.
Well, we know that. I don't know if you saw that film, Grizzly Man, in which Tim Treadwell, you discuss him in the book, so you obviously have seen Werner Herzog's film. He thought he could live with the bears. And he wound up paying a price for that.
Right, and he picked not a black bear, which is a pretty tame and non-threatening smaller species, but he picked an Alaskan brown bear, which is a grizzly bear, these bears are just huge. And I think that anthropomorphizing just in his case was obviously out of hand, but we all have a tendency to think about wildlife as pets.
And well, Bambi has dissuaded an awful lot of people from ever considering eating venison. I think there may be all sorts of reasons to not eat venison, but people will say, oh, how can you eat Bambi?
Well, as one writer put it in the Times, Steve Ranella, venison is locally produced, antibiotic-free, free-range, humanely killed locavore protein, and I eat it all the time. It's wonderful.
Well, that's because you're not a vegetarian.
That's true.
It's not likely in the years to come that humans will become any more isolated from animals. So what steps can people who come in contact with them regularly do to minimize the risks to their health and property?
Well, it depends on the species, but I would stress that that feeding wild creatures and thinking of them as outdoor pets or guests is probably not the way to go. You want to instill fear in coyotes and bears. You don't want them hanging around. You don't want to you don't want to feed them. With deer, various things you can do. You can fence your yard. You can put out chemicals and so on. Canada geese, I don't know if they've taken over your kid's soccer field. You ought to probably give your soccer field back to your kids.
But you're not suggesting putting out poison bait or something like that.
No.
There's a movie about that. It just came out, a man who puts out poison bait to kill all the squirrels and causes a lot of trouble.
No, I love to have these things around. I just don't want them running into my car and eating my garden.
Jim Sterba has been a foreign correspondent, national reporter for more than four decades for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. He's the author of Frankie's Place, a love story. And now the book we've been discussing, Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into battlegrounds. It is published by Crown. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks very much for having me.